Orson Welles speaking. Last Sunday, I made you a proposition. I offered to trade you one of the new Lear radios for any letter I use on this program. Well, I've spent most of this week reading my mail. There's enough for 100 broadcasts. First, I want to thank you for a lot of good reading, and then I want to assure you that the offer stands from here on in. We'll get to that in just a minute.
America has been waiting a long time for fine new home radios. No one knows this better than Lear, L-E-A-R. And that's why Lear is determined that any radios this company makes shall have every worthwhile advance in radio engineering that it's possible to include. Lear is in a unique position to do this, for even before the years of Lear's concentrated war work, this company was making radios that had to have the finest, most advanced design and construction. These were aircraft radios. Now, the experience of 16 years of this kind of manufacture is being turned to making Lear radios for your home. One of the advanced features is the new sound-on-tape recording, first announced by Lear just a few weeks ago. This is like wire recording, but is many steps ahead of anything that has been done before. At the touch of a switch, you capture children's songs and voices and all the good times you want to enjoy over and over. These recordings can be used again and again for a lifetime. But any time you don't want to keep what you've recorded, it's erased from the tape just by recording something else. When you see these new sets, you'll know that it was well worthwhile to wait for the radio with the nameplate Lear, L-E-A-R. Now, back to Orson Welles.
Before the letters, I'd like to take a minute for a word about a new movie. It's called A Walk in the Sun. Harry Brown's book, For My Money, was the best writing in our language to come out of the war. And Louis Milestone's film version is the best war picture to date. It ought to get the Academy Award, but it won't. But that shouldn't stop you from going to see it. And please don't stay away because it's about soldiers. The soldiers are people, real people, and real people are very rarely encountered these days on the screen. To a man in my business, fresh from the plush foxholes of Hollywood, it's very heartening to be able to hail something truthful and warm and good. We've been sleeping through a dreary night of dreams in movie land, and the first faint cockcrow of dawn is worth noting. It's about time we woke up and got back to work. Now, don't get me wrong, I like to laugh and forget my troubles as much as anybody else. But man does not live by ice cream sodas alone. So please do me a favor and go and get your friends to go and see A Walk in the Sun. It's high time we started proving that the eight-year-old mentality belongs not to the movie audience, but to the movie producer. And now about the letters and the radios. Any letter I use gets the writer a radio, but understand, please, this isn't a contest. Neatness doesn't count in a literary style. There are no judges and no rules. The best letter doesn't win, in other words, since no effort will be made by anybody to decide what the best might be. I'd just like to include some of your opinions on this quarter hour of my opinions, for the use of which I'm paying off with a fine radio, a table model, a five-tube one made by Lear. Now, I don't want to impose on the generosity of the makers of the Lear radio, and today there are at least three letters I can't resist reading, so I'm making up the difference myself and very gladly. Writes Roy C. Carlson, former United States Marine, "Dear Welles, you want a letter, and I want a radio. Crime authorities say we're in the midst of a post-war crime wave, and in an indirect way say it's being caused by vets and GIs. Well, if a guy can't get a job, a home, or a suit of clothes, what do you think is going through that fellow's mind?" Unquote. Mr. Carlson gets his radio. "I wish it were as easy for all veterans to get clothes and housing and work. It's just as tough as Mr. Carlson says. Today, 6 out of 8 veterans who go to the United States Employment Service looking for work wind up jobless. 60,000 vets in New York alone are now living on their unemployment compensation. That amounts to $20 a week. For many jobs, 10 or a dozen vets come back to claim their veterans' priority. Obviously, only one can exercise it. There simply is no veterans priority on most jobs. The current wave of strikes has led many vets to discover a hitherto rather unnoticed clause in the GI Bill of Rights. We've pointed it out on this program before. The clause says that veterans cannot collect unemployment benefits if they're unemployed due to a strike in which they participate or are directly interested. Well, my hunch is that that clause was written in order to turn vets against organized labor. The Federal Housing Authority has ruled that no GI home building loans will be approved for any vet involved in any way in a strike. Do you know anybody today not involved somehow in a strike? What's needed is a permanent long-range housing project on a nationwide basis, but no such project is yet underway. So vets still sleep in vacant lots and empty sewer pipes, and more of them every night. Even vets that have homes are having a hard time getting back to them, so They sleep in vacant lots, too, and in empty sewer pipes. The airlines held most of their eastbound seats for vets for a brief period, but they stopped doing that on January 15th. Troop trains run many hours, sometimes several days, behind trains carrying regular passengers. So the veterans, finished fighting the Germans and the Japanese, fight here to get on passenger trains so they can get back to the homes they fought to defend. Over the holidays, I heard of several wounded vets struggling along on crutches who were knocked down and trampled underfoot in civilian mobs madly rushing for trains. One on crutches, his leg in a cast, had a broken leg rebroken in the Washington railway station. He didn't get home for Christmas. He went back to the hospital. And when vets finally do get home, if they have a home, the first thing they want to do is get out of uniform. But now that, too, is getting to be impossible. Ex-GIs have to compete for suits with men who never got out of civvies and who simply want to add one more suit to their wardrobes. Couldn't vets be given a priority, definitely entitling them to purchase at least one suit of clothes? Just one? Well, a vet does get home if he can find a home. He often wants to go into business for himself. He's heard that veterans are supposed to get priority on obtaining surplus war property. He tries to buy some, a truck, a desk, a file cabinet. He doesn't get it. A senator complained the other day that he has yet to hear of a single GI who's managed to buy a surplus army truck. Meanwhile, thousands have been sold to established business concerns run by men who spent the war piling up the cash on war contracts to buy fleets of trucks to make more cash on peace contracts. So it looks like the veteran is going to have to clothe his body in his khaki-colored underwear, put on his uniform, hoist up his duffel bag again, and go back into the army, where at least he has a cot in the barracks to sleep on. On the other hand, there's still the United States' old soldier's home. Well, since the war is over, there's been a tremendous boom throughout the country in the spiritualist and fortune-telling rackets. On this program, I've been trying to expose the racketeers. They're costing the public too much money and inflicting too much real personal harm to be tolerated any longer. Now, I've no wish to attack any man's religious beliefs. I'm after the crooks who fatten off those beliefs. Today, a Lear Radio goes to a devout and sincere spiritualist, Mr. Edward W. Woods, whose letter is too long for me to read, but which quotes one Arthur Ford to the effect that he, Mr. Ford, gave Mrs. Houdini the code she and her husband agreed upon as being conclusive evidence that her husband had survived death. I hope to have, within a week or two, conclusive evidence that Mrs. Houdini was never satisfied, that, in fact, the code was never broken. Mr. Woods, by the way, writes me the letter, tells me not to argue with the medium who is giving me a reading. Take a pencil and paper, says Mr. Woods, and write down what she says, and then wait and see. I ask Mr. Woods to examine the implications of that statement. I ask him to ask himself why any supernatural agency powerful enough to divine the future requires a thought or question to be committed to writing. Isn't it obvious, Mr. Woods, that a real prophet wouldn't need anything on paper? Mr. Woods mentions Dunninger as being an excellent mind reader. The fact is that Dunninger is a most convincing and entertaining magician. But I am convinced that Dunninger is not a mind reader. If there is such a thing as telepathy, it's on the record as a very fitful and unreliable spark. The regular practice of mind reading is the regular practice of trickery and hanky-panky, nothing more. I made an offer last week, and I'll stand by that offer. If any man or woman claiming supernatural powers can produce phenomena which I cannot duplicate by natural means, he or she gets a television set with my warmest compliments. It may even be that a soothsayer or a mind reader might find television useful, at least during periods of relaxation. Well, here's a letter from somebody who signs himself C.W. Brooks, with an address in Cleveland, Ohio. Quote, "The favorite remark in all speeches today seems to be racial tolerance. Where do the advocates of racial tolerance expect it to stop? Where do the colored people expect it to stop? Just how far are we expected to go? Surely there must be some things the colored people don't want us to do. Please accept this question the way that it's meant, a question that is in the minds of millions of fair, honest citizens. Can you, or the colored people, get a fair answer for us?" Unquote. My dear Mr. Brooks, quite unconsciously, you make a distinction between citizens and the colored people. And it's just here that you'll find the fair answer to your question. The colored people want a fair chance to be citizens, too. They want to be full citizens with the full rights of citizenship in a government founded on the proposition that all men are created equal. The fair and honest citizens of whom you speak may well count this opinion dangerous and radical. But the fathers of our American Revolution held it to be self-evident. Where, you ask, do the colored people expect it to stop? It being racial tolerance. Well, personally, I don't like the word tolerance. It strikes me as a patronizing word. I don't believe one race is something another race must tolerate. I don't think we have to put up with the colored people, for instance. I think we should live with them, if we expect to live with ourselves. Just how far, you ask, Mr. Brooks? Just how far are we expected to go? Citizen Brooks, we're expected to go as far as the Declaration of Independence. As far as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness described, if you will remember, as inalienable rights. Of course, it's more than possible that some of your fair and honest citizen friends will hear only the word alien in the word inalienable. They should be reminded that equality is an American idea and that the justification of inequality, by any means or any argument, is foreign and subversive. Citizen Brooks, I'm sending you at my expense a radio. I hope it brings you pleasure and profit. It's a good radio. But I can't vouch for what you'll hear on it. Certainly not many frank discussions on this matter. But you'll hear Marian Anderson, maybe, and Duke Ellington, and if you're interested, a college professor or a scientist who happens to be a Negro. They may help to answer your question. Mind you, they're good Negroes. They know their place. And Mr. Brooks, it's a place of high honor in American society. You'll also hear on some of the comedy programs on your radio jokes perpetuating the dangerous myth of the shiftless, lazy rastus, good for nothing but shooting craps and eating watermelon. Surely, you say, there must be some things that the colored people don't want us to do. Mr. Brooks, that's the sort of thing they don't want us to do. Most of the colored people in this great rich land of ours are badly housed, improperly educated, and undernourished. On top of all that misery, why make fun of them? I'm sure you don't want to, and I hope you can see that you and I don't have to give up anything at all in order to give all Americans what they deserve. I am, sir, your obedient servant. Now, your attention, please, for an interesting announcement.
When you think over the fact that Lear has 16 years' experience in building ultra-fine aircraft radios, you get some idea of what to expect in the Lear radios designed and built for your home. There's a whole line of them, capable, dependable, good-looking sets, styled with the beauty of tomorrow and fashioned with the master craftsman's touch. Some of these sets will have television, some FM, shortwave, and an entirely new remote tuning control that lets you select any station on the dial and adjust the volume from your easy chair across the room. And, of course, some will have the new Lear sound-on-tape recording that we've been telling you about. With all their quality and with all their advanced features, Lear radios are not high in cost. There's one to meet every requirement and at every price. The fine console combination radio phonograph with television, FM, recorder, and all sells for about $500. And at the other end of the line, there's the capable, good-looking table model for about $19.95. We know you want to hear these new Lear radios, and your Lear dealer will be glad to point out all their features and advantages. We'll tell you just when your nearby dealer will have them. And when you do hear them, we know that you're going to find that dollar for dollar, you get the most for your money when the radio you buy is a Lear. L-E-A-R. Now back to Orson Welles, whose views and opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent those of Lear Incorporated.
I'd like to read you just a few lines from one more letter. Dear Mr. Welles, I was blinded 5 years ago. Nobody cared if I lived or died. Nobody cared if I starved to death. And one can starve to death in this land full of plenty. People for whom I've done many favors wouldn't even say hello when I met them on the street. Nobody has ever offered to read to me, and few people have ever visited me. Mr. Welles, there are people in this world who will steal from a blind man. Unquote. I hope the radio I'm sending Mr. Haggerty, who wrote me this letter, will lighten that terrible darkness just a little and help his loneliness. We wish him everything that can be wished and more. Well, my time's up. Thanks for listening, and let me come to call next time.
This is the American Broadcasting Company.